Chapter 9. Raised but perhaps narrowed by close study of the past, the view of a generation of architects in whom archaeological curiosity had stifled the artistic instinct, and who, instead of assimilating the spirit of the past like their great predecessors, were engrossed in a sterile restoration of the letter. It may be said of this school of architects that they were of more service to posterity than to their contemporaries, for while they opened the way to modern antiquarian research, their pedantry checked the natural development of a style which, if left to itself, might in time have found new and more vigorous forms of expression. To Odo, happily, Count Benedetto's surroundings spoke more forcibly than his theories. Every object in the calm, severe rooms appealed to the boy with the pure eloquence of form. Casts of the Vatican busts stood against the walls, and a niche at one end of the library contained a marble copy of the Apollo Belvedere. The sarcophagi with their winged genii, their garlands and bucrons, and porphyry tazzas, the fragments of Roman mosaic and Pompeian fresco painting, roused Odo's curiosity, as if they had been the scattered letters of a new alphabet, and he saw with astonishment his friend Vittorio's indifference to these wonders. Count Benedetto, it was clear, was resigned to his nephew's lack of interest. The old man doubtless knew that he represented to the youth only the rich uncle whose crotchets must be humored for the sake of what his pocket may procure, and such kindly tolerance made Odo regret that Vittorio should not at least affect an interest in his uncle's pursuits. Odo's eagerness to see and learn filled Count Benedetto with a simple joy. He brought forth all his treasures for the boy's instruction, and the two spent many an afternoon poring over Piranesi's Roman etchings, Maffei's Verona Illustrata, and Count Benedetto's own elegant pencil drawings of classical remains. Like all students of his day, he had also his cabinet of antique gems and coins, from which Odo obtained more intimate glimpses of that buried life so marvelously exhumed before him. Hints of traffic in far-off marketplaces, and familiar gestures of hands on which those very jewels might have sparkled. Nor did the Count restrict the boy's inquiries to that distant past, and for the first time Odo heard of the masters who had maintained the great classical tradition on Latin soil. San Michele, Vignola, Sansovino, and the divine Michelangelo, whom the old architect never named without baring his head. From the works of these architects Odo formed his first conception of the earlier, more virile manner which the first contact with Greco-Roman antiquity had produced. The Count told him, too, of the great painters whose popularity had been lessened, if their fame had not been dimmed, by the more recent achievements of Correggio, Guido, Guercino, and the Bolognese school. The splendor of the stands of the Vatican, the dreadful majesty of the Sistine ceiling, revealed to Odo the beauty of that unmatched moment before grandeur broke into bombast. His early association with the expressive homely art of the chapel at Pontesordo, and with the half-pagan beauty of Luini's compositions had formed his taste on soberer lines than the fashion of the day affected, and his imagination breathed freely on the heights of the Latin Parnassus. Thus, while his friend Vittorio stormed up and down the quiet rooms, chattering about his horses, boasting of his escapades, or ranting against the tyranny of the Sardinian government, Odo, at the old Count's side, was entering on the great inheritance of the past. Such an initiation was the more precious to him from the indifference of those about him to all forms of liberal culture. Among the greater Italian cities, Turin was at that period the least open to new influences, the most rigidly bound up in the formulas of the past. While Milan, under the Austrian rule, was becoming a center of philosophic thought, while Naples was producing a group of economists such as Galiani, Gravina, and Filangieri, while ecclesiastical Rome was dedicating herself to the investigation of ancient art and polity, and even flighty Venice had her little set of eyebrows, who read Voltaire and Hume and wept over the rights of man, the old Piedmontese capital lay in the grasp of a bigoted clergy, and of a reigning house which was already preparing, to superimpose Prussian militarism on the old feudal discipline of the border. Generations of hard fighting and rigorous living had developed in the nobles the qualities which were preparing them for the great part their country was to play, and contact with the Waldensian and Calvinist heresies had stiffened Piedmontese piety into a somber hatred of schism, and a minute observance of the mechanical rules of the faith. Such qualities could be produced only at the expense of intellectual freedom. And if Piedmont could show a few nobles like Massimo Deseglio's father, who ate the education of his children his first and gravest thought, and supplemented the deficiencies of his wife's conventual training, by consecrating to her daily 4 hours of reading, translating and other suitable exercises, the commoner view was that of Alfieri's own parents, who frequently repeated in their son's hearing the old maxim of the Piedmontese nobility, that there is no need for a gentleman to be a scholar. Such at any rate, was the opinion of the old Marquess of Donnas, and of all the frequenters of Casa Valdu. Odo's stepfather was engrossed in the fulfillment of his duties about the court, and Donna Laura, under the influence of poverty and ennui, had sunk into a state of rigid pietism, so that the lad, on his visits to his mother, found himself in a world where art was represented by the latest pastel portrait of a court beauty, literature by Liguori's Glories of Mary, or the blessed Battista's Mental Sorrows of Christ, and history by the conviction that Piedmont's efforts to stamp out the enemies of the Church had distinguished her above every other country of Europe. Donna Laura Sisisbio was indeed a member of the local Arcadia, and given to celebrating in verse every incident in the noble household of Valdu, from its lady's name day to the death of a pet canary, but his own tastes inclined to the elegant Bettinelli, whose lettier Virgilian had so conclusively shown Dante to be a writer of barbarous doggerel. And among the dilettanti of the day one heard less of Raffle than of Carlo Maratta, less of Ariosto and Petrarch than of the Jesuit poet Padre Sivo, author of the sublime Eroico comic poem on the infancy of Jesus. It was in fact mainly to the Jesuits that Italy, in the early part of the 18th century, owed her literature and her art, as well as the direction of her religious life. Though the reaction against the order was everywhere making itself felt, though one Italian sovereign after another had been constrained to purchase popularity, or even security by banishing the society from his dominions, the Jesuits maintained their hold on the aristocracy, whose pretensions they flattered, whose tastes they affected, and to whom they represented the spirit of religious and political conservatism, against which invisible forces were already felt to be moving. For the use of their noble supporters, the Jesuits had devised a religion as elaborate and ceremonious as the social usages of the aristocracy. A religion which decked its chapels in imitation of great ladies' boudoirs, and prescribed observances in keeping with the vapid and gossiping existence of their inmates. To Odo, fresh from the pure air of Donnas, where the faith of his kinsfolk expressed itself in charity, self-denial and a noble decency of life, there was something stifling in the atmosphere of languishing pietism in which his mother's friends veiled the emptiness of their days. Under the instruction of the Countess's director, the boy's conscience was enervated by the casuistries of Liguorianism, and his devotion dulled by the imposition of interminable pious practices. It was in his nature to grudge no sacrifice to his ideals, and he might have accomplished without question the monotonous observances his confessor exacted, but for the changed aspect of the deity in whose name they were imposed. As with most thoughtful natures, Odo's first disillusionment was to come from discovering not what his God condemned, but what he condoned. Between Cantapresto's coarse philosophy of pleasure and the refined complaisances of his new confessor, he felt the distinction to be one rather of taste than of principle, and it seemed to him that the religion of the aristocracy might not unfairly be summed up in the ex-soprano's cynical aphorism, "As respectful children of our Heavenly Father, it behoves us not to speak till we are spoken to." Even the religious ceremonies he witnessed did not console him for that chill hour of dawn, when, in the chapel at Donnas, he had served the Mass for Don Gervaso, with a heart trembling at its own unworthiness yet uplifted by the sense of the divine presence. In the churches adorned like aristocratic drawing rooms, of which some Madonna, wreathed in artificial flowers, seemed the amiable and indulgent hostess, and where the florid passionate music of the Mass was rendered by the King's opera singers before a throng of chattering cavaliers and ladies, Odo prayed in vain for a reawakening of the old emotion. The sense of sonship was gone. He felt himself an alien in the temple of this affable divinity, and his heart echoed no more than the cry which had once lifted him on wings of praise to the very threshold of the hidden glory, Domen, Dilexi Decorum Domus Tui A Locum Habitationis Glorii Tui. It was in the first reaction from this dimly felt loss that he lit one day on a volume which Elfier I had smuggled into the Academy the Letters Philosophiques of François Eraut de Voltaire. Book 2. The New Light. Zu neuen Ufern lockt ein neuer Tag. 2.1. One afternoon of April in the year 1774, Odo Valseca, riding down the hillside below the Church of the Super Ga, had reined in his horse at a point where a group of Spanish chestnuts overhung the way. The air was light and pure, the shady turf invited him, and dismounting he bid his servant lead the horses to the wayside and halfway down the slope. The spot he had chosen, though secluded as some nook above the gorge of Donnas, commanded a view of the Po rolling at his feet like a flood of yellowish metal, and beyond, outspread in clear spring sunshine, the great city in the bosom of the plain. The spectacle was fair enough to touch any fancy. Brown domes and facades set in new-leaved gardens, and surrounded by vineyards extending to the nearest acclivities, country houses glancing through the fresh green of plains and willows, monastery walls cresting the higher ridges, and westward the Po winding in sunlit curves toward the Alps. Odo had lost none of his sensitiveness to such impressions, but the sway of another mood turned his eye from the outstretched beauty of the city to the vernal solitude about him. It was the season when old memories of Donnas worked in his blood, when the banks and hedges of the fresh hill country about Turin cheated him with a breath of budding beech groves, and the fragrance of crushed fern in the glens of the high Pennine valleys. It was a mere waft, perhaps, from some clod of loosened earth, or the touch of cool elastic moss as he flung himself face downward under the trees, but the savor, the contact filled his nostrils with mountain air, and his eyes with dim branched distances. At Donnas the slow motions of the northern spring had endeared to him all those sweet incipiencies preceding the full choral burst of leaf and flower. The mauve mist over bare woodlands, the wet black gleams in frost-bound hollows, the thrust of fronds through withered bracken, the primrose patches spreading like pale sunshine along wintry lanes. He had always felt a sympathy for these delicate unnoted changes, but the feeling which had formerly been like the blind stir of sap in a plant was now a conscious sensation that groped for speech and understanding. He had grown up among people to whom such emotions were unknown. The old Marquess's passion for his fields and woods was the love of the agriculturist and the hunter, not that of the naturalist or the poet, and the aristocracy of the cities regarded the country merely as so much soil from which to draw their maintenance. The gentle folk never absented themselves from town, but for a few weeks of autumn, when they went to their villas for the vintage, transporting thither all the diversions of city life and venturing no farther afield than the pleasure grounds that were but so many open-air card rooms, concert halls and theaters. Odo's tenderness for every sylvan function of renewal and decay, every shifting of light and color on the flying surface of the year, would have been met with the same stare with which a certain enchanting countess had received the handful of wind flowers that, fresh from a sunrise on the hills, he had laid one morning among her toilet boxes. The Countess Clarice had stared and laughed, and every one of his acquaintance, Elfier I even, would have echoed her laugh. But one man at least had felt the divine commotion of nature's touch, had felt and interpreted it, in words as fresh as spring verdure, in the pages of a volume that Odo now drew from his pocket. I longed to dream, but some unexpected spectacle continually distracted me from my musings. Here immense rocks hung their ruinous masses above my head. There the thick mist of roaring waterfalls enveloped me, or some unceasing torrent tore open at my very feet an abyss into which the gaze feared to plunge. Sometimes I was lost in the twilight of a thick wood. Sometimes, on emerging from a dark ravine, my eyes were charmed by the sight of an open meadow. Nature seemed to revel in unwonted contrasts, such varieties of aspect that she united in one spot. Here was an eastern prospect bright with spring flowers, while autumn fruits ripened to the south, and the northern face of the scene was still locked in wintry frosts. Add to this the different angles at which the peaks took the light, the chiaroscuro of sun and shade, and the variations of light resulting from it at morning and evening. Sum up the impressions I have tried to describe, and you will be able to form an idea of the enchanting situation in which I found myself. The scene has indeed a magical, a supernatural quality, which so ravishes the spirit and senses that one seems to lose all exact notion of one's surroundings and identity. This was a new language to 18th century readers. Already it had swept through the length and breadth of France, like a spring storm wind bursting open doors and windows, and filling close candle-lit rooms with wet gusts, and the scent of beaten blossoms. But south of the Alps the new ideas traveled slowly, and the Piedmontese were as yet scarce aware of the man who had written thus of their own mountains. It was true that, some 30 years earlier, in one of the very monasteries on which Odo now looked down, a Swiss vagrant called Rousseau had embraced the true faith with the most moving signs of edification. But the rescue of Helvetian heretics was a favorite occupation of the Tournese nobility, and it is doubtful if any recalled the name of the strange proselyte who had hastened to signalize his conversion by robbing his employers and slandering an innocent maidservant. Odo in fact owed his first acquaintance with the French writers to Alfieri, who, in the intervals of his wandering over Europe, now and then reappeared in Turin laden with the latest novelties in Transalpine literature and haberdashery. What his eccentric friend failed to provide, Odo had little difficulty in obtaining for himself. For though most of the new writers were on the index, and the Sardinian censorship was notoriously severe, there was never yet a barrier that could keep out books, and Cantapresto was a skilled purveyor of contraband dainties. Odo had thus acquainted himself with the lighter literature of England and France, and though he had read but few philosophical treatises, was yet dimly aware of the new standpoint from which, north of the Alps, men were beginning to test the accepted forms of thought. The first disturbance of his childish faith, and the coincident reading of the Lettres Philosophiques, had been followed by a period of moral perturbation, during which he suffered from that sense of bewilderment, of inability to classify the phenomena of life, that is one of the keenest trials of inexperience. Youth and nature had their way with him, however, and a wholesome reaction of indifference set in. The invisible world of thought and conduct had been the frequent subject of his musings, but the other, tangible world was close to him too, spreading like a rich populous plain between himself and the distant heights of speculation. The old doubts, the old dissatisfactions, hung on the edge of consciousness. But he was too profoundly Italian not to linger while in that atmosphere of careless acquiescence that is so pleasant a medium for the unhampered enjoyment of life. Someday, no doubt, the intellectual curiosity and the moral disquietude would revive, but what he wanted now were books which appealed not to his reason, but to his emotions, which reflected as in a mirror the rich and varied life of the senses. Books that were warm to the touch, like the little volume in his hand. For it was not only of nature that the book spoke. Amid scenes of such rustic freshness, were set human passions as fresh and natural. A great romantic love, subdued to duty, yet breaking forth again and again as young shoots spring from the root of a felled tree. To 18th century readers, such a picture of life was as new as its setting. Duty, in that day, to people of quality, meant the observance of certain fixed conventions. The correct stepping of a moral minuet, as an inner obligation, as a voluntary tribute to Diderot's divinity on earth, it had hardly yet drawn breath. To depict a personal relation, so much purer and more profound than any form of sentiment then in fashion, and then to subordinate it, unflinchingly, to the ideal of those larger relations that link the individual to the group, this was a stroke of originality for which it would be hard to find a parallel in modern fiction. Here at last was an answer to the blind impulses agrope in Odo's breast, the loosening of those springs of emotion that gushed forth in such fresh contrast to the stagnant rills of the sentimental pleasure garden. To renounce a Julie would be more thrilling than Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.